Up next, this panel discussion from the Center for Social Innovation at Stanford explores some of the complex issues that arise when attempting to measure social impact.
On Social Innovation Conversations.
Hi, I'm Chris Dagelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation.
And I'm Eric Nie, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Today, we're excited to bring you another presentation from Bridging the Gap. Bridging the Gap was the 2005 Net Impact Conference convened by the Stanford Graduate School of Business.
To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
And now, here is our presentation from Bridging the Gap.
Let me briefly introduce who we all are up here in the front of the room. My name is Rick Aubrey. I wear two hats. I'm the president of Rubicon Programs, which is a nonprofit organization here in the San Francisco Bay Area, which for many years has tried to use the measurement of impacts to improve the quality of our work. And I also teach social entrepreneurship here at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford. We're very fortunate that we have such an incredibly strong panel to talk about this very important issue. Let me start on this end, introduce to you Jason Saul. Jason is the executive director and founder of B2P Commerce, which in fact develops real tools to measure performance and analyze impact in the public nonprofit organization space that we're all a part of. And as you'll see, we really have a very rich panel that works from both the ground level of actually doing something about it to helping create a deeper understanding of the field, as David Bonwright does, our next panelist here, who is the founder and chief executive officer of Keystone, which is an organization that's worked with NGOs and governmental agencies throughout the world, both to provide a greater strategic understanding of what measurement and impact measurement needs to be and helping define the field to be able to do it. And on my immediate left is Paul Brest, who is now the president of the Hewlett Foundation and has been for several years. Prior to that, Paul was here at Stanford as the dean of the law school as well. And during his tenure at Hewlett, Hewlett has taken a very active role in making measurement and impact a much more critical part of how they do philanthropy. So I think you're going to see that we really have, from the largest conceptual level within foundations, from the level of how do we start rolling this out into the field, and from the level of how do we in fact do this work on the ground so that nonprofits can in fact better measure their impact, you've got a great panel to talk about this work. So why don't we get right at it, and let me start with Paul, who will give us the high-level big picture of why this work matters and what the work really is all about. Paul.
Thanks, Rick, and thank you all for coming. Let me frame, I'd like to give an overview about achieving and measuring impact, and I want to frame it with two comments. One is that talk about metrics is the enemy of understanding and assessing impact. It makes people panic and close down and run the other way. Eventually you need to come back to it, but it just scares people. Secondly, I had a meeting yesterday with an intermediary organization that has grantees of its own and is developing a 5-star system for rating grantees based on their impact. And in some sense, consistent with my first statement, I would give 3 stars to an organization that had a good strategic plan based on a sensible theory of change, even before you got to impact. The other 2 stars I would give for impact. There are very few organizations that would get 3 stars of the ones that I know. Okay, so here's some comments. One is the ultimate goal of every nonprofit organization and foundation is to achieve impact. And impact means 2 things. It means making something good happen, and secondly, making something happen that would not happen otherwise. So to give some examples from our work, we're trying to reduce CO2 emissions in order to reduce the rate of global warming. We work on improving outcomes in school districts. We also work in sustaining performing arts organizations in the Bay Area. And in all of these areas, the goal is to make something happen that wouldn't otherwise happen. Long before you get to measuring impact, you need to have a plan based on a sound theory of change. I'm going to focus mainly on measurement, though, as you'll see, I'll circle back pretty quickly to the importance of a sound theory of change. So what is the ideal measurement of impact? It's to know whether you had the impact and to what extent, and to know what contribution your organization made to it. If your organization is devoted to praying every evening to make the sun rise tomorrow morning, then certainly you achieved the outcome you wanted, but it's at least questionable whether you contributed to it. So the contribution is important as well. The ideal of measuring outcomes is randomized, controlled studies, the sort done with new pharmaceuticals, or econometric analyses of real life happenings. The reality is that is very difficult to do for much of the work that we and you all do. For one thing, a lot of the ultimate outcomes occur only in the long run, as Keynes famously said, in the long run, we're all dead. And that's certainly true, for example, of our work on climate change. We will not know whether we actually had an impact on climate change until certainly after I and my colleagues are gone from the foundation and probably gone from the earth. Even in the short term, it is difficult and expensive to get data and analyze it to find out whether you're making a difference. It's especially difficult for the organizations that do the actual work on the ground. Many of them are set up to do, but not really set up to do social science measurements. So what's the accommodation between reality and the ideal? Here I circle back. The first accommodation is being very clear about what outcome you are trying to achieve, about just what impact you're trying to have. And then secondly is to be very clear about the causal steps. Some people call it a logic model. But the causal steps that you need to achieve the outcome. That is to simplify, but it's usually worth simplifying, you know, from A to B to C to the outcome. What does it take to get there? So we are currently working with grantees on trying to get Congress to adopt a cap on CO2 emissions. That is a step that we think will lead to reduction of CO2 by the United States that will reduce global warming. Notice that there are some strong theories of change in there, including the physical or chemical theory that reducing carbon dioxide emissions reduces global warming and that global warming is bad. To give another example, we're interested in reducing unintended pregnancies and HIV/AIDS among teenagers in Africa. A theory of change that we have is that girls attending school for a longer period of time results in less sexual activity, results in being married at a later time, which in marriage, it turns out, for many of these girls is puts them at higher risk, leads to the outcome we want. That's a complicated theory of change. It is hard to evaluate. It's certainly the particular grantee who is a school in Kenya is not able to do this. So it calls for social science evaluation beyond what the grantee can do. But without a strong theory of change, you're just spinning your wheels, right? You can be implementing something, but if you don't have the social science and science facts wrong, then you're not going to achieve the outcome. So what are the implications of this? One is you need to evaluate your theory of change. There are lots of wonderfully, intuitively obvious theories of change that turn out not to be true. Then you need to evaluate the organization's progress toward its theory of change. If the goal is to, you know, if an important part of theory of change is that teenage or pre-teenage girls should stay in school, then you want to know how many are staying in school compared to before you intervened or compared to other schools. This is, as I say, the domain of social science and science. It's evaluation of this sort. Social science studies are vastly underfunded by foundations. And foundations have the primary responsibility to do this. there's a tendency on all of our parts to want to do stuff rather than find out whether what we're doing actually makes a difference, and I think that's a real shame. From the organization's point of view, though, it has to assess progress. No organization can operate without knowing whether it is making progress from A to B to C, if that is what its own strategy is, and that requires monitoring, and that's something which I hope Jason will talk about, because he certainly has provided interesting, important tools for that. So evaluation in the sense of monitoring is what everybody needs to do. You need feedback. For those of you who have ever piloted a plane, as I used to, or a boat, you know the dead reckoning. You know, you start here, you use a compass and aim for there, and if you don't get feedback on course, you're going to end up far away from your destination. You need feedback to stay on course. When you can be quantitative, it is ideal, and I think one should always strive to have quantitative measures of progress and quantitative measures of impact. And when you've done your best and you can no longer be quantitative, that's the time to be qualitative. But challenge, one should challenge oneself. And I guess my last point is, two points, one of which is captured beautifully in the name of this conference. Net impact implies, it's not gross impact, it's net impact. It's how much bang do you have for the buck. That is, every decision an organization or foundation supporting it makes is money that could be used for something else. So you want to make sure that you're getting good impact for the money. And finally, a subject probably a little bit off of our focus, but just important to make, is almost everything that nonprofit organizations and the foundations that fund them do is high risk. Usually not high risk in the sense of doing harm, although sometimes we can do harm, but high risk in the sense that we make a large investment of money and it may not work. Without taking risks, a huge amount of the important work that the nonprofit sector does never would have been done. An important part of the context in which measurement takes place is one in which you should expect failure. No venture capitalist expects most of his or her organizations in the portfolio to succeed. No foundation should expect most of its grants to succeed. And the honesty that comes from allowing failure and using the word failure, even if you learn from it, is an important part, I think, of giving ourselves the freedom to measure and the freedom, really, to innovate. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. So I think that's a very helpful context for us to now dive into it. David, you worked on the ground for many years. You got kicked out of some countries sometimes for actually trying to do some great things. And now you founded Keystone to try to create some strategy and systems for actually being able to do this evaluation. What is that central role? Tell us a little bit about that.
Great. Thank you, Rick. Yeah, I want to tell you about this initiative Keystone, but it follows in an extremely congenial way from Paul's conceptual framework. And in fact, I would like to kind of adopt in whole that framework and work from there. It'll help the process. But the first point I want to make, and I think it's somewhat implicit in what Paul was saying and very explicit in what Rick is saying, is that there's a move in the world now to kind of impose from the outside a greater rigor around measurement on social change organizations and a great concern around outcomes and measurement. And to a very large extent, that's kind of coming from the outside. And my first point is that it's a right concern, it's an important pressure, but the solution is going to come from inside the social change world and from social change practitioners. So Keystone is an effort to create a kind of inside-out response to the challenge of social impact measurement. And what we're saying, very much in line with the framework that Paul has just stated, is that if we're going to succeed at creating methods for impact measurement that become widely used and widely adopted, and therefore we can start to head toward, if you will, a generally accepted method or a standard, this will happen if and only if it supports and strengthens learning-based relationships from the different actors. So when you have an investor or a funder like the Hewlett Foundation that says, it's okay to fail, but you've got to learn, and it's got to be done within a particular rigor, that starts to create the space where we can get serious about metrics. And I think absent that, it just won't happen. This is speaking now as a practitioner and experience the kind of pressures that organizations on the ground have to deliver quote-unquote results to donors, and the way in which people on the ground are incredibly innovative about responding to external pressures without really dealing with the substance of it. And so the first point, and I think we all have to remember this and carry this flag forward, is that is learning really happening in the relationships that are at play around some social? And for us, this is the kind of core thing around which Keystone will stand or fall. The second point is that when we start to come to how do you do this, we believe that it needs to happen through robust, structured conversations between an organization and all of its stakeholders. Now, obviously, you can't speak to all of them, so you speak to representative sets, but you speak to the full spectrum. And for us, we put a kind of affirmative preference to those stakeholders who are most affected by the work of the organization, the beneficiaries, the people in whose name the social change is seeking to be created. And this is really at the heart of our metrics methodology at Keystone. So I'm going to give you a quick overview of what Keystone is and how it works and what the propositions are as a method. And when you hear it, one of the things you're going to think, I think, is that there's nothing fundamentally new about it, and you would be right. What we're saying is that the stuff that we need is all out there, but it's never been assembled in a kind of end-to-end way in a continuous process that allows us to get the kind of overall metrics method that I think we need. So where we can make a claim to originality is that we're assembling a method that begins inside organizations with functions like strategic planning, but arrives at guidelines for public reporting and enables a kind of two-way public reporting infrastructure where you can start to get feedback loops at the highest level around public reports. So what is the method? There's four core propositions and three organizational cycles. And you all should have a little two-pager. And I apologize because for those of you whose eyesight is a bit like mine, in the enthusiasm for greening the conference, I think we may have sacrificed something in the way of functionality here. But I think most of it's readable, but you certainly won't be able to read the cycle diagram. And I guess I understand these kinds of materials are going to be available on the website afterwards, so you'll be able to get this in a form that's more readable. But to start with the four propositions, which is the bottom right slide on the first page, we're basically making four core propositions, which we are then trying to help organizations realize effectively. The first is that social outcomes and impact derive from many actors in an ecosystem. Too often, metrics requirements and accountability requirements that are put on organizations, in a sense, require them to make claims around their contribution to an outcome that are unrealistic. And we start from the opposite place, and we say, actually, we want to hear from you, social change actor, how it is you understand and leverage the other actors around a problem, so that we can actually see the full system that we call an ecosystem around a particular problem and solution. And we want to understand how you are aligning, confronting, engaging, partnering with others to solve the problem. Okay, second proposition is that impact depends on learning at individual, organizational, and societal levels. So I've said a bit about this already, that learning kind of in learning-based relationship lies at the core of our metrics model. But to say a bit more, each of us has a unique conception of what is desirable, what should change is, what good is. And in listening actively to differing voices, an organization gains the knowledge and sets the terms of engagements that form the basis of its own contributions to human knowledge and learning and problem solving. So there's a sense in which any organization which is promoting some public good is constantly choosing, or better yet, mediating and embroidering upon the different understandings of its different stakeholders. So what we look for in an organizational culture is a kind of culture of inquiry rather than sanction, values reflection, recognizes and embraces difference, and encourages trial and error mentality. And I cannot emphasize how important this is. As soon as you start to go into situations where you're dealing with, and which is in every difficult social problem, you're starting to move against, moving across class, race, education levels. So you start to try to get into those heterogeneous environments. It's so important the kind of learning and listening and valuing culture that can be created. Which brings me to the third proposition, which is that impacts depend fundamentally on the ways that those with power are held to account for the use of that power. So a little background on this. The first thing is that learning theory teaches us that we learn when we have to. We learn when what we normally do is not working, and we need to learn in order to realize some objective. So when you translate this out and look at different sectors of society, and there's a kind of performance principle here. So it's widely recognized when we look at governments or businesses that they perform best when they're held to account by those they work with or for. So we visit this kind of accountability on governments when we exercise our votes. We, as consumers, we insist on choice, and we buy from companies that respond to our needs. Why would we settle for any less powerful performance principle when it comes to solving our most important social problems? So how do we get this kind of accountability into social change contexts? Well, we ask organizations to speak with their stakeholders, to set explicit agreements about respective roles, responsibilities, and deliverables, to set together indicators of success for attaining those deliverables, what would success look like, and then to periodically review progress against the agreed indicators with their stakeholders. So for those of you who've been wondering at what point I was going to talk about outcome measurement, this is it. And what we're saying is that it's most powerful when it's set in this kind of agreement-making framework with stakeholders. And again, particularly those stakeholders most affected by the problem. So typically, such agreements are increasingly in place between donor institutions and nonprofit organizations. But where they're not typically in place is with respect to beneficiaries, the people in whose name the work is undertaken. So our method is an attempt to remedy this particular failing. Finally, the fourth proposition, very quickly, that impact depends importantly on operational integrity. I don't think that in this audience I need to defend that principle, a business-minded group, but if I do, I'll leave it to question time. So Keystone works then through three flexibly structured stages or processes that organizations go through to more deeply realize these four propositions. It begins with a self-profiling or self-diagnostic moment where the organization looks at its current capabilities and practices in light of the four propositions. It then moves into an internal reflection stage where they really challenge, do we have a clear statement of objectives? Do we have a theory of change and a causal model? And those are terms that we use and endorse and support. Can we map our ecosystem and say specifically how we work with each of the actors in it? Then they move to the dialogue stage where they reach out to their stakeholders and in a sense embed and refine and develop these ideas from the reflection stage by socializing them into their stakeholder relationships. And then the third cycle, finally, where you move into the public reporting space. And for me, this is the kind of culminating element that begins to create the larger ecosystem in the world for more effective resource allocation for social change. Because when this kind of information becomes available in the public domain, investors, grant makers, and others are going to be able to operate from a whole other level in terms of where they choose and how they choose to engage with organizations. Okay, last point. One of the things when it comes to the public reporting dimension of Keystone is that we require organizations to report not only on their stated goals and their progress against their goals according to agreed indicators, but also what it is their stakeholders said about what they said they had achieved in that past period. So there's a kind of reality check and a feedback loop that's built right in. So when they go back and report first to stakeholders, they record what happens there, and they then go into their public reporting and have to include both things. So there's a kind of reflexive dimension. So I think I was going to talk a little bit about our theory of change, but I'm going to skip over that and leave that to any questions or interests of that may come from all of you. Just to say that what we're aiming to do is create a method of social change and practice that quickens our learning and vitalizes our organization through strengthened relationships among and between all the constituencies for progress. That is to say, all of us. But all of us aligned around the voices of those in whose name the work is undertaken. So we who work for the public good have always put the benefit, those who are meant to benefit from our work, at the center of our purpose. I think what we're saying is now it's time to put them at the center of our practice. Thank you.
Thank you, David. That's very helpful. Jason Saul, if we can turn to you now. You teach this at Northwestern, you've worked in this field, and you've purposely chosen to actually create a company which produces a tool, B2P, to address this issue. Could you tell us a little bit about how you understand the issue overall and why B2P is an important thing to help solve this issue?
So, maybe it was 10 years ago. I was sitting in the same seat as you were at the Kennedy School as a master's student saying, yeah, I hear you, I agree, we got to measure, it's all really important stuff, there's all these different methodologies, but what can we actually do about it? I mean, we hear all these ideas, but what's happening to operationalize these concepts so that we can actually answer the question practically, tangibly, meaningfully, are we making a difference? You know, foundations alone are spending $300 billion a year on social impact, and individuals a lot more, governments, corporations, we've got to be able to answer this question in some practical way beyond concepts. So I left this big law firm I was at, raised venture capital, and started a company, a software company, to essentially build systems and methods to measure performance. It's quite similar to accounting, right? I mean, before we had Gap, before we had QuickBooks, you know, we were using an abacus, and before that, we were sort of dead reckoning. You know, yeah, I guess this, you know, grain is worth about three of your furs, but we need to move beyond that in this in the work we're doing. It's way too sophisticated. There's way too much money going on. So we've been developing a system. We've developed a system to essentially measure performance and sort of like a business intelligence tool. What I wanted to kind of do today is just kind of give you some of the context around the work that we've been doing and some of the lessons that we've learned in trying to ground truth this stuff, which is very difficult, both in terms of motivations, business drivers, why would anybody actually measure this stuff if they don't have to? Two, what does that actually mean? What are you measuring? And then three, how do you actually collect the data and do something with it? So let me preface it by saying this. There are two reasons why anyone makes an investment in a social problem. Any foundation, any government. They only really invest for two reasons. One, because they've bought into your theory of change. You've already proven it, they've bought it, and they want to fund it. And the second is because it sounds compelling, like David's, and it's unproven, but it's a new idea, and we want to test it and see if it works. But that's it. You either invest in something that's proven and you want to improve the results, or you invest in something that's unproven and you want to prove that it's truly having an impact. So the field is essentially, you know, stratified between those two extremes, and there's a handout I've given you that's just one page. What I call it a measurement continuum. And I think the first thing that's really helpful is just to kind of clarify the conceptual geography of logic models, outcomes, performance metrics, benchmarking, theories of change, program evaluation, longitudinal randomized impact studies. And how does this all sort out? So I try to kind of put this together, and this is helpful to a lot of the clients that we work with too. If you look at this, on the one hand, you have kind of the proving side of the spectrum, right? So as Paul was saying, randomized impact studies, you know, organizations in New York like MDRC, the Manpower Demonstration Research Corporation, that'll do, you know, a longitudinal randomized impact study on welfare to work programs over the course of 5 years. They've actually done a lot in California to show under a particular set of conditions for a particular population of people at a certain time in a certain place, this program worked. Is it going to work again somewhere else with another set of people under different circumstances? We don't really know, but we can learn something from having that control group. And so on the extreme left, you have kind of what I call research or formal program evaluation. Moving from that, you start to move towards strategy. And as Paul was saying, a logic model development, thinking about what is your theory of change, how do you operationalize causation in your organization? What are your inputs? What are your activities? What are your outputs? What are your outcomes? What ultimate impact? Trying to put all that down, that's not a measurement system. It's essentially a tool for helping you articulate your strategy. And it's very powerful, and you can't measure if you don't know what you're trying to accomplish. So it is, in fact, precedent. So you have a logic model. And that sort of informs your strategy. Your strategy helps you figure out, you know, how are you going to try and improve literacy, or how are you going to try and solve homelessness, or how are you going to try and affect the outcome that you're trying to get at. And from that, you create a program design. But then you reach the murky process of, okay, now what? So we're doing all this stuff. We're doing all these activities. We're putting on conferences, disseminating, you know, brochures, or putting up a website. We're talking to people. But how do we know what's going on? And so that's where you get into actual performance measurement territory, which is setting indicators that indicate the extent to which you're actually achieving an outcome. A lot of people then move performance measurement into a management framework. So actually, how do we manage the organization by virtue of these metrics so that we have individuals who are accountable for certain outcomes and we can actually see how well we're doing as an organization? A lot of organizations, that's not enough. A lot of you come from the business world and say, okay, that's just a given. We got to manage how we're doing and know what our indicators and performance is, even if it's non-financial. But how do we improve? Well, that's what the whole concept of benchmarking is. I just wrote a whole book about it, so it's hard to summarize that in a word, but it's basically how do you actually take ideas, and benchmarking in the nonprofit sector is obviously even more complicated because everything's so inchoate and abstract, but you can actually look at metrics and look at internal benchmarks and say we want to do that much better next year, and look at external benchmarks from other people that are trying to achieve the same outcomes, even though they may be doing differential activities. One person's running an arts education organization, the other's doing a job training program, but you're both trying to improve skills. So what metrics are you using that you can learn from each other on how best to improve skills? Or a drug rehabilitation program and a youth violence prevention initiative are both trying to reduce the incidence of a bad behavior. They're very different activities, but they're hitting the same outcome. And so there's got to be some common ways of reducing bad behavior, or improving skills, or improving the awareness of an issue, or enabling people to achieve employment. Any of these kind of common outcomes that exist. So this is a helpful tool for understanding the conceptual geography, and I think it's very important to delineate the difference between evaluation and performance measurement. So in the reality of actually building a business around this, the first thing that you confront is the business driver. No one buys anything unless they have to, right? So, you know, particularly in selling to the nonprofit sector, you learn quickly that you can't sell vitamins. You got to sell painkillers. Right? People can't afford vitamins. We can only do what we have to do. And so it's difficult in a sector where there are really no hard business drivers of why you have to measure performance. I mean, sure, it's important to our mission. And absolutely, it's good management. And definitely the market's asking for it. But if you don't, it's not like the IRS is going to take away your 501c3 status. So people like David, organizations that like the one that Paul leads, are creating a culture of measurement and accountability. But it's very difficult when you're working with organizations who really don't have a hard driver. So you have to work with the early adopters, show people that it's possible. And once we've been doing this for the last 5 years, now I think it's sort of the opposite of the principle of necessity is the mother of invention. It's sort of that invention is the mother of necessity. Right? Now that it's possible to measure impact, we have to. It's now necessary. We've kind of shown that it's doable. It's no longer an excuse that it's too hard. So you kind of reach the bottom line of, so how do we operationalize this? What are people actually doing? So we're working with foundations, community foundations, Fortune 500 companies, national nonprofits that are tracking actual data. And what they're trying to do is the following. They're essentially, what we've essentially built is an accounting system. If you think about the way accounting works, you have a chart of accounts, and in our world, we have a chart of metrics, right? And you have a series of transactions against those accounts, right? And here we have a series of activities that are generating results for those metrics. And then you have reports that show your actual to budget, or in this case, your, you know, actual to benchmark. And so it's essentially akin to an accounting system where you're tracking metrics that are pre-derived in a chart of accounts, and you're reporting on your actual results to your board, to your funders, and to your management. And so we think about it that way. And the system we build is called Impact Manager. It's used primarily by foundations to give their grantees capabilities to track their results and report back to the foundation, so the foundation can aggregate their results and show their impact, and also benchmark grantees and learn from each other in that culture. It's also used by national organizations who want to aggregate, you know, hundreds of chapters. Easter Seals or Ronald McDonald Houses are all doing the same thing, but want to benchmark and learn from each other because they're doing common things. But I'll say, you know, in closing, that I think the single biggest challenge is not the business driver, because it's coming. It's not the conceptual geography, because it's pretty clear and there's pretty, you know, accepted documentation in terms of how to do this stuff. But it's the standardization of it all. Imagine doing accounting without a accepted chart of accounts. Imagine doing accounting without GAAP. It's really impossible. I mean, you're comparing apples and oranges, so the best you can do is measure ripeness, right? Well, this apple is about 80% towards its goal, and this orange is about 60%. But we got to do better than that. And if you look at the world in a different way, and I ask all of you to think about this differently, the first thing every nonprofit says is we're different. We're doing different things. First Book is different than Streetwise, is different than Independent Sector. But at the same level, in the same sense, if you look at organizations at a different level, not by their activities, not by what they do, but by their outcomes, what they're trying to achieve, the black box opens and this amazing transparency emerges where we're actually all doing the same thing. We're all trying to improve skills. We're all trying to reduce unwanted behavior. We're all trying to improve desirable conditions. We're all trying to increase self-esteem and economic security. And there's some very common things that we can learn from. And so standardization, if we think about it, is a very powerful concept. It's what Keystone's working on. It's what the Center for What Works is doing. And the Urban Institute is starting to articulate some common metrics around the sector so that we can start to, A, have better tools for tracking what we're doing instead of reinventing the wheel every time we have to measure something, but B, comparing and learning so that the ultimate purpose of measurement is not accountability, it's improvement. We want to do that much better every year. We want to have that much more impact and spend that much less money. And so at the end of the day, we really want to improve results, not just track them. And I leave you with that concept. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. So on one hand, hey, I'm convinced this measurement stuff is great. Well, you know, we should all do it. But in fact, at least in many people's experience, there's still a tremendous gap between the ideal that gets represented here and the real in terms of how much measurement, in fact, does occur. Do philanthropic and government decisions and individual donations really get based upon who's having impact as opposed to who knows whom and all of those sort of issues? So I want to have a little bit of a conversation with all of you and say it's great, you know, we're all doing great work, but it's sort of in the context of, well, if we're so smart, why ain't we rich? Why is it, in fact, that this is still something that is not, in fact, how primarily decisions get made in the social sector in terms of where money's social capital, if you will, should flow? And let me sort of ask each one of you some questions about that. I mean, is it... The way I've thought about it, based upon what you said, is it at the highest level this sort of structural issue that you can't compare different kinds of nonprofit organizations, so fundamentally you can never get to that? Is it at the operational level that it's just very hard to do this measurement? Or is it in some ways at the political level that people, in fact, don't really want to know the answers to these things? They want to fund what they believe in, that philanthropy and governments are very much faith-based entities, that they invest based upon their faith, in that sense of faith, of course, rather than upon science. And that's really the paradigm that tends to rule outside of a small panels of people who want to do things differently. So I really want to get at this and ask these more provocative questions. What do you, each of you, think are really the most important issues that have to get solved for impact measurement to really become the dominant paradigm? Paul, let's start with you in philanthropy. You're doing a lot of work at Hewlett Foundation. Many foundations still have what our colleague Melinda Twan called the dance of deceit. They don't really always want to know the truth because it's hard for a program officer to tell that to a board. A board wants to think that what it's investing in is good. What does it take within the philanthropic world to make what you would hope to be the case more so the case?
Yeah, I actually would add to Jason's biggest challenge. I actually think before you get to standardization, you get to two things. Neither one is the one you mentioned, although the ones you mentioned also may happen. One is that for some reason, many people in the sector don't understand or think it's important to have a strategic plan for their own work. What's astounding is, you know, you think about anybody who's done a do-it-yourself home improvement project, and implicitly and very often explicitly, they've done the strategic plan. You're trying to build an improvement to your house, and you know where you're going, you know what materials you need, and how you're going to get there. And somehow, when that same person enters her office on Monday morning, having done this over the weekend, and dealing with much more complex issues of social change, somehow they can't do the same strategic plan. It's as if the complexity of it makes you just give up. So that's one barrier. The other, which I think applies to many funders, including foundations, is there doesn't seem to be a demand for either clarity about strategic plans or about outcomes. I mean, one of the things that we've encountered, and I think increasingly we see ourselves trying to create a demand, right? Not for ourselves, we demand it, but among donors to nonprofit organizations, to say we really care about impact and we want to know how you're doing. And it's only after you create the demand that you get, I think, to the issues of standardization that Jason's talking about.
Let me just push back, though, Paul or any of you, how do you incentivize that demand? I mean, there are market forces that go on, and it, just as Jason said, you sell aspirin so that people get the reports out, but how do you, in fact, make people want to be healthier?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's again, sort of invention is the mother of necessity. Having transparency and having the data out there will prompt people to ask better questions. You know, I think There was a study that was published in the Stanford Social Innovation Review, maybe some of you read, but basically said donors don't care. Donors don't care about performance measurement. Well, the specious, you know, issue in that research was it asked donors, you know, what do you currently use to make a decision? Well, they can't use something that doesn't exist. Of course they don't use performance data because there is none. I mean, that's like saying, what do you currently eat on your way to the moon? Well, I don't go to the moon, so I mean, it's just, I can't tell you. So it's sort of obvious that, of course, they don't use performance measurement. But actually, there was another study that a student of mine did at Kellogg in his marketing class on if performance metrics existed and you had a choice between two different charities and you could see the actual results of one versus the other, would that influence your decision? And a majority of the people said yes. And so I think the issue is it comes down to actually having data that's available. Now, there's always going to be people who donate for social reasons, right? There's three kinds of donors. What I call social donors, right? Like my mom, who, you know, there was this children's hospital who, you know, a friend of hers was on the board. And they said, you know, Yolanda, can you please donate? She's an art collector, this great painting. So she was going to donate it. And I said, Mom, you know, how do you even know if this organization is any good? Well, you know, my friend's on the board. So, you know, being the overeducated person that I am, I went on to GuideStar and actually found all their financial stuff and saw that for the last 2 years, for all of their fundraisers, they spent more in expense than they generated in revenue. So she essentially was vaporizing her money, but she didn't care. She's like, I like this organization, they're helping the kids. Social donor, right? Then you have the economic donor, who's, you know, the Fidelity, you know, charitable gift fund. Basically, I don't care. I want a tax deduction. Just give me a tax deduction. I'll give it to my alma mater, whatever. I just want to get the money. And then you have the outcome donor, you know, like Hewlett's and like others who say, I'm purchasing results. I want to know. And I think more and more of those are emerging, in, you know, from our generation and from technology and entrepreneurs and self-made people who want to bring a business practice, but we need the data to be able to have those decisions even be possible.
I'll add another perspective to this. It kind of picks up from Paul's point about an internal constraint among practitioners, that there's a kind of need to really increase the commitment to an understanding of the need for better kind of strategic planning type processes, and I would add, and accountability to stakeholders, and I put the two together in the way that I explained. I think that's true. It's certainly true of my 25 years of working with groups around the world in social change. But I think there's a chance here to really quickly shift that supply side issue, because as soon as you sit down with social change practitioners and you begin to offer a way to do this that they see they can do, it's so consistent with their values and with the reasons that they're there that it's really just, it's pushing on an open door. I mean, I think we can see very, very, very rapid uptake of better practices if we can put the kind of methods out there in a way that people can use them. This is, nobody dedicates their life to working in nonprofit organizations and for social change when they could be making more money and having an easier life somewhere else if they really didn't want to make a difference in it. That's one of my premises. And so when you come along and you offer something that helps them achieve that more effectively, that's great. But I also think we do need to work on the structural incentives and create the rewards for nonprofits that take this journey. And that's where, you have to work on both sides of the equation at the same time, and therefore identify leading donors and or donors who are prepared to be leaders in this and really put their necks out and say, this is very important, and projects that want our support have to go down this trip. And also there's a set of organizations that are emerging that are addressing the retail giver, which is the online giving marketplaces. And I think they're a very important part of this story. I think in the future, when people are given a choice to invest in A, B, or C nonprofit organization, and they're all there transparently on a website, and two of them or one of them is giving real performance information and the other two aren't, and one of them is very clearly accountable to its beneficiaries and the other two aren't, I think the funding from ordinary givers in small amounts will start to flow toward those people. And we can't, this is one of our hypotheses, and we intend to test it over the years. So we are working with the emerging giving marketplaces to create a common underlying standardization issue, common underlying quality assurance and evaluation model, so that there's interoperability among these emerging giving marketplaces.
I'd like to open it up to questions now, and please, I'll start here and we'll work our way back. Please, go ahead.
Also thinking about your comment about how when you say metrics, all the nonprofits run, and wonder if you agree with my thought that foundations need to make it okay for a failure and a learning failure to actually be a positive metric, in a sense. Do you think that would help, and do you think there are things you can do to make people articulate failures that way?
I think that's very important. I mean, first of all, this begins at home. That is, if the foundation staff themselves can't talk about their failures, then we're not going to be very good at communicating honestly to grantees that they should be candid. So we started, for example, a couple of years ago, we have a contest for the worst grant of the year. The worst grant from which you learned the most. But an entry condition, because even, it's interesting, after 3 years of this, some of our staff still doesn't want to use the word failure. So this year's rules, we're just about to do it, you have to say this grant failed, and you learn from it. And then I think being, once you've done that, then you can convey honestly to grantees that failure is okay. It's not always okay, right? I mean, it depends why the grantee failed. I mean, if you failed because you just screwed up implementation the way that no organization should, you know, the kind of thing where CEOs of other companies get fired or go to jail, then your grant ought not to be renewed. But if you failed because we knew we were taking a risk and you did some stuff and it didn't work, it didn't work as well as you did, then you go back and say, well, you know, maybe the theory is completely wrong, but maybe it's right and we should work on implementation. But I think that does require, you talked about a dance of deceit, it requires really doing a lot of work to counter that.
Mm. We had a question back here, I think, please, and it's hard for me to see the helmet. Go ahead.
Yeah, Bruce Cahan from Urban Logic. I guess I want to address this to Jason, but I'll address it to everybody. I've been part of a group at Brookings that's looked at community statistical systems and the role that they could play to accelerate NGOs knowing their stakeholders without reinventing that wheel, taking 20 or 30% of every grant dollar and investing it in who are we supposed to serve, but actually have some shareware. And when I posed the institutional problem to, I think it was someone at MacArthur, to name names, and said, okay, would you, as part of your grant-making process, allow a grantee's budget a line item for IT shareware? The answer was sort of a dumbfounded, well, no, we don't do that. That's not part of our budgetary process. So I think when you're looking at this accountability tool, it's part of this knowledge management movement within the social change world that has no, to borrow an analogy, no foundation center. There's no place that all the grant or organizations say, okay, let's archive your knowledge of Harlem or the problems in the Bay. Let's, as a condition of the grant, make sure you do that and then hold you accountable to how much communal knowledge you made shareable. So I'd like to just give that insight and ask for your reaction as part of the metrics.
Well, actually, MacArthur is one of the people that we've worked with to do just that. So they have a big national community development initiative called Living Cities that they've created that a lot of other funders fund to fund all basically the affordable housing initiatives in about 26 different cities. Enterprise and LISC are kind of underneath that. So one of the things they've done is create essentially a system where every single CDC in all 26 cities reports on their metrics or contributions to those affiliates, which report up to the nationals, which report up to all the funders. And so they actually started to create that system. One of the complexities that we've run into, though, is there's two different types of data that people want, right? One is what you've referred to, which is the demographic data, essentially what I call the problem data. What is the homelessness rate in this particular neighborhood, or what is the percentage of blighting in this area, versus the kind of success or performance data where you want to superimpose that and say, in an area under these types of conditions, what theories of change are effective or what interventions work. And so we've been focused on collecting the performance of the success data, but the next stage is to actually superimpose it on the problem data. But it is a challenge. Again, I think it comes back to business drivers and what grants are trying to accomplish, and also back to what the incentives are for program officers. One of the program officers I interviewed when we were doing some work for a foundation said, I get paid to get grants out the door. I don't get paid to make impact. I get paid if I get X number of dollars out the door every year, and my systems are set up to monitor that, and my incentives are based on that. So, you know, it comes back to Paul's point about the culture of the foundations, where the drivers are, I think.
So let me. I think this is a apparently provocative question. You want to weigh in?
Just a quick comment that I think the kind of causal assumption behind that initiative is something about the importance for making knowledge that's resident in the community or practice visible to all and accessible to all. And I would just say we would strongly resonate to that, and that our ecosystem principle, or principle number one, is really an effort to try to create organizational processes that begin to do that kind of as organizations move along and engage with each other around a problem in a community.
Let me pose another question to the panel, spinning off this one. Is the problem that there still is just not an accepted standard, or until there's sort of a Microsoft or Linux or whatever of what is acceptable data, everyone's going to want to use their own system? Or is it that funders still think too much as individual silos about how they want to particularly address an issue, and it's got to be their information and their grant? Is there any thoughts about that?
What do you think, Paul?
I don't think it's either of those problems.
Okay.
I mean, if if each organization, each foundation had its own outcome measurement system, I would think we were so far ahead of where we are. Mm-hmm. Then we can worry about standardization. But first you need the motivation to have that. Right.
Good. Okay, so I'm going to try to get as many folks in as possible. And
My question is for David. I was wondering if you could give a concrete example of how the model that you described has been applied and in particular interested how your model addresses the issue that Paul brought up about a lot of social change impact being very long term and that being preventive issues for measuring it. So say if it's an organization that has a very long timeline, how do you address that?
Sure. Okay, well, I think the first thing to say is that we're kind of in the early R&D laboratory stage on this, though the group of people who are doing it have all got, kind of a couple decades or more of social change work on the ground. So it's an experienced team, and when we're asked to give examples, we tend to draw from our work and our life before Keystone, as it were, and this is, in a sense, a kind of manifestation. A coming together, an assemblage of things. But I'll just give one quick real example from some of our on-the-ground partners now. The first, in the internal reflection stage, where groups sit down and start to really press on their strategy, what tends to happen, we sat down with a rural school reform program in the Eastern Cape and in South Africa, and really put them through a series of questions about their strategy, which they had a written strategy, but it didn't really have a clear logic model, and it certainly wasn't articulated clearly, though some of them had it. As that came out, they immediately realized that they needed to take their ideas about school reform and move them into stakeholder dialogues around the schools, and they went out and did it, just boom. So it provoked an immediate decision to start to take some new actions. And those dialogues then started to give them feedback and accountability structure that changed the way they worked. So those are the kind of quantum jumps that we start to see. And we've seen it again and again with groups that are taking it up, that there's a quick recognition, hey, we're missing an important thing here of getting some real feedback with real partners, people that we care about. And we need to socialize, if you will, what we're doing at the planning level. And in order to do that, you have to get clear, because you can't go out to communities and be unclear about your objectives, because the questions just start piling up in front of you and you create confusion. So the long-term issue, it's a dialogue process that starts to provide the answer. If you can indicate to your stakeholders your big goal and the intermediate steps that you expect to see happen to reach that goal, then they will work with you to define the short-term indicators. And then you work around those. So that becomes the point around which you are accountable. So you're not accountable for the big goal, you're accountable for the short-term goal that you've agreed together. And then at the moment of reviewing the short-term goal, you ask the next question, well, does this seem like we're still on track in terms of our causal theory toward the big goal? So it's a way to manage the long-term nature of it.
Let me add one quick thing, so I think it'll be helpful. There's something we call, Paul liked this from the law background, penumbras of impact, right? And so you have, it's essentially what we talk to a lot and I teach in my class, you have essentially a conceptual net present value. You guys get that from the business world, right? So out here, right, so here is your time horizon, and here is your level of impact. Okay, and this is essentially what Dave is talking about. This is your ultimate arc, right? This is changing the world. But in order to ultimately change the world, what do you got to do, right? Well, you probably need to be able to improve economic sustainability. And so in order to do that, you need to be able to create more jobs. So how do you do that? You need to improve skills. So how do you do that? You have to people show up in your classes. How do you do that? You got to be able to have a bunch of advertising. So if you look at this kind of progression, this is really, what I call the zone of impact, is right here. You're never going to measure this, changing the world, and no one really cares whether you're doing a bunch of advertising or hits on your web. But what they care about is what is within reasonably, years 1 to 3 that you can, what outcomes are in that intermediate zone that you can demonstrate are actually going to make a difference and that you can measure towards. So that might just be a helpful tool.
Very nice.
Please.
I came here because I'm kind of a measurement agnostic. So I teach at the business school here, and as a researcher, when I put on that hat, I have to measure. And we have elaborate seminars where we argue over measuring very subtle kinds of things. And I've also experienced teaching about business that in the world is incredibly difficult to measure. So you go into any Fortune 500 company and you start asking questions about what is the profitability of this line of business or that unit. And if they can answer at all, it's very difficult to measure. And no organization that I know of has ever measured the impact of their R&D unit, which is exactly the kind of high-risk study you guys are talking about. So I want to believe in measurement because the researcher at me loves that, but the business professor at me knows that the world gets by on much less measurement than possible. And so I was wondering, kind of following up on the question that you asked, can you guys give a couple of really juicy practical examples for measurement, as opposed to, you know, you're talking about the stakeholder conversations with groups. I believe that, and I believe that getting clear on strategy is useful. Can you guys give a couple of juicy examples about whether measurement itself really helped turn something around or change the way that people were doing things or help the learning process?
Here's a great example, right? So Easter Seals has 91 affiliates and chapters around the whole country. And their brand is very important to them. They do more than just put stickers on envelopes. You know, they actually, their purpose is to help kids with disabilities get by in life. And so they wanted to be able to improve the effectiveness of all those different 91 chapters. And trust me, not all of them were equally high performing. And so they one of the things that they realized was in the capacity measures they put on each of their chapters, that employee satisfaction was quite a critical indicator of the overall organization's performance, because management effectiveness was an indicator of overall management effectiveness. So they did benchmarking across every one of these affiliates and found that there was one in Atlanta that had basically 95% employee satisfaction. And what they found was there was a tool that that organization was using to gauge and respond to employee satisfaction that they believed was the causal relationship or the predicate for why that was such a high benchmark. And so they used that tool at one of their best practice summits to share with all the other affiliates, and it got adopted all over the place and helped increase employee satisfaction across at least 5 other Easter Seals affiliates. I mean, that's one concrete example I can give you.
Let me also separate. I think the R&D thing is an interesting analogy. Separate out a company's R&D and it's turning out widgets. Mm-hmm. And for the widgets, you want to measure. And you know, if you're a soup kitchen, you want to know how much it costs per meal. And you know, Jason's suggesting that if you have a number of soup kitchens, you can begin to standardize the cost per meal and compare organizations. A lot, when a foundation or a nonprofit invests in R&D, testing a new theory, the issue is not measurement. The issue is implementing the theory and then doing kind of the social science evaluation and see whether it works, in the same way that, you know, when something comes out of the HP lab or Bell Labs in the olden days, you know, you want to find out whether it actually works. So I want to separate that kind of evaluation from measuring widget manufacturing.
Chip, you still an agnostic, or have you gotten religion?
I'm on the track with Jason's example, but I'm, you know, one more juicy.
Well, read my book. There's 100 in it.
I don't have a juicy example, but I kind of along the same line. In a sense, Jason pushed toward internal benchmarking and external benchmarking as a way organizations can improve their performance or their management decisions. I think that's a relevant category. But just notice that in the world, if you look at how funding, you know, kind of decisions or, if you will, fads go, there's been a huge shift toward areas that are measurable. Hence the huge emphasis, especially from new donors, on microfinance, despite the fact that there's a lot of evidence that shows that microfinance by itself doesn't necessarily solve poverty problems. It contributes to it, but there's a whole lot of things that have to happen around it. Same thing on the whole public health issue around, you know, vaccinations or the like, that you can make some short-term gains with very clearly measurable results. But you don't necessarily solve the deeper problems around building sustainable public health delivery systems in those poor places alone, unless you do other things. So in a way, I kind of want to agree with you to say that it measures, well, I guess I'm saying measures do drive certainly donor behavior. And then there's a question as to whether that's the best way to go or by itself.
Okay, please, there.
Following on the examples those questions. What organizations have you found to be the best at measuring social impact?
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples. I won't necessarily put them in the category of best because I don't.
Yeah.
And interestingly, I think it sort of connects to Paul's concept that if you're clear about your theory of change, typically you're clear about what you need to measure, and then you can test whether or not what you're doing works or not. So, organization called Apertech, they're now called Kickstart, believes that by bringing low technology tools to developing countries, you can significantly improve the quality of life for people that are there. And they have very basic measures. They look, and it's very easy, unfortunately, to get sort of random samples because they're not affecting as many people as as the problems exist. But by providing some of these technology, very low-tech tools, they measure over time the economic livelihoods of these families who have these water pumps or these oil presses as compared with everybody else in the village. And they measure things like how many of their children now go to schools compared to the normative state. Do they have cash in an almost non-existent cash economy? So they're, by being very clear that they think that technology, in fact, can have a significant impact, and by measuring what happens when you provide those technologies, they can measure their difference. Same thing as the fair trade coffee movement here, Transfair, another organization. Their theory of change is that if you somehow leverage the power of consumers in the developing world to affect the living standards of people living in very poor communities, you can have a significant impact. So they measure the living standards of the people who are part of the co-ops that are fair trade co-ops as compared with other co-ops. And again, they measure the same sorts of things. What's happening to the next generation? Are more kids going to school? Do they now have money to invest? All those sorts of things. So if you're clear about your theory of change, you can then go ahead and measure impacts.
Rick is being very modest, not talking about his own organization.
Yeah, exactly.
Because Rubicon, and in fact the portfolio of organizations that REDF funds and works with, these are workforce development programs which hire people who have histories of criminal records, drugs and the like, and they are incredibly good at measuring how long people stay in the workforce, staying off drugs, a whole lot of outcomes. And indeed, REDF, which invests in at different times in different numbers of these, can compare the success of its investee organizations.
A couple of examples? Good. Okay, let's go over here. Thank you, Dan.
Do you think that the organizations that are good at measuring their outcomes are organizations that focus on outcomes that are being measured? And is this kind of a chicken and egg thing where,
yes,
there's some things, the program that I was working in last year, I was working to get kids in the fifth grade to keep them from getting pregnant when they were 16. And that, I mean, I'm not going to know where those kids are when they're 16. So I don't know. I mean,
that goes back to a point I made about the difference between validating a theory of change and which is something that social scientists can do, and measuring particular outcomes. If we're investing in a teen pregnancy program, and we're spending as much money on evaluation as we are on the program itself, and evaluating not just this program but other programs that use the same theory. If once you establish that there's a particular methodology that works reasonably well, and you know how well it works to keep fifth graders from getting pregnant, then each organization doesn't need to validate itself. What the organization needs to know is that it's taking the steps that make sense under this theory. But most organizations of your sort can't track the ultimate outcomes. So that's why it's so important to evaluate the theory. And then what Jason's measures do is not necessarily evaluate the theory, but saying, okay, if the theory calls for doing this, let's see how well we're doing this, which is within our power.
Did you have a sense of what impact you were having on those girls or whoever the...
Well, I mean, that's an example of one of the outcomes that I was working on. I was working under the model with the 40 developmental assets, which is something that is search institute developed to kind of answer this question about measurement with youth programming. And I mean, there were a lot of measures. And fortunately, our program met the, you know, the kids, the measure that, we had to achieve in order to get the funding was standardized reading tests. And so, you know, fortunately, we met that one, so we were able to do other things. But it's, you know, it's interesting the hoops that you have to jump through to achieve, you know, the things that you want. And when nonprofits go where their funding is. And so, you know, these 1, 2, 3 year grant cycles, when you're trying to change the world in 50 years, it's very difficult.
And do you know whether standardized reading tests have anything to do with preventing pregnancy?
No, I don't think
right.
they do.
Right.
I think that's
well, so that's the, you know, the difference between, you know, the theory change. Okay, please. We only have time for 2 very quick questions. My apologies, but this is a shorter session than the rest, so please go ahead.
Several nonprofits, or, you know, very common thing in nonprofits, where they're entering data into multiple computer systems, which are all outdated because all their grantees require different things, and, you know, the government changes the name of the program every year, and then also changes how you're being judged, etc. I feel like there is a great need for greater standardization to, if you really want the outcomes to match to the true strategy of the organization. So.
I completely agree. What I was saying is, I'd like to get to a point where foundations care enough about this to have any systems. But I agree that the specially funders that are funding the same organization ought to collaborate on reporting and have a single reporting format.
But just a datum here, you know, when Jim Wolfson was heading the World Bank, he tried very hard to get all of the bilateral and multilateral aid donors to agree to a common reporting framework. And there were 2 global meetings that the World Bank hosted, and they made 0 progress on this because none of the individual donor institutions, even with Wolfenson pushing so hard from the top, there were none prepared to give up their prerogatives for complicated and many times understandable internal reasons. So that's why I'm saying I think it actually has to come importantly from the practitioner side, that's the way to lead this.
So one more question, and then we'll take just 1 minute to wrap up, and then off to lunch. So go ahead, please, in the back.
I'm really intrigued with the whole issue around incentivizing. In my line of work, I work with nonprofits of all different sizes in all different sectors and doing all different types of activities. And one consistent theme is that in order to fund something like Impact Measurement, they either have to take it out of their working capital. Most of the time, they don't have enough to do that. Or they get it from a grant. Or some kind of enlightened donor who will help them with that kind of investment. And I have examples of, you know, a California statewide foundation that puts down $10,000 for a strategic plan and a fundraising plan. I mean, that kind of underinvestment is huge.
Right.
And so, to me, my question for you is, to what extent do you see, you know, the philanthropy side of it providing that incentive and not forcing, you know, 10 to 15% overhead numbers, those kinds of requirements that prevent a lot of nonprofits from actually making that investment?
I think a lot of it is the doing of donors. I think you're right. Donors are not motivated, and then they underinvest. They underinvest in general support, because to the extent that you get general support, then you can use it freely for what you think is important, and they probably underinvest in capacity building as well.
Just as somebody seeking those kinds of support, the handful is too small of foundations that think the way that we would like them to think. And I don't think yet we're at a tipping point where it's just a couple more getting on board that are significantly going to change it. So. Unfortunately, hopefully that will be the future, but it is still a daunting challenge for most nonprofits.
I'm really glad to hear that you invested as much money on the programs as on the measurement piece, too. So that's very, very impressive.
Unfortunately rare.
Yeah.
So just in summary, thank you very much. I think we've had a great panel. So first, give them all a great hand. And the graduation speeches as MBAs, you have very significant roles. Both many organizations allow you to do internships and board fellowships at all within nonprofits. And certainly your knowledge about measurement is an invaluable tool that you can bring in both for the short term as well as when you eventually become leaders in the nonprofit sector. So thank you so much.
You've been listening to a presentation from the Bridging the Gap Conference.
Bridging the Gap was the 2005 Net Impact Conference, convened by the Stanford Graduate School of Business.
To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Stephen Eng. Our website editor was Leah Silverman. The series producer is Bernadette Clavier.
This is Chris Steigelmeier
and Eric Nie on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.